Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Chris Skelly. Today we're covering the continued unrest in Albany as the community confronts police brutality.
Then we'll have part three of Willie Terry's coverage of the Underground Railroad History Project's LibertyCon 2019 conference.
We'll also hear from Mark Dunley's report from the recent Forum on Environmental and Climate Justice in Albany.
And we'll have an interview about continuing attempts to pass the Medical Aid in Dying Act in New York State.
And finally, we remember longtime musician, journalist, and artist Greg Hames, who passed away last week.
But let's start the show off today with some headlines. A rally against police brutality took place on Sunday at Townsend Park in Albany. This comes after Albany police body camera footage of an incident in March was made public. Quote, "We've been dealing with police brutality for so long, said Sandra Thompson, mother of Armando Sanchez. They keep telling us that change is being made. No change is being made. Only change is going to be made when these officers start going to jail, end quote. One Albany officer, Luke Deere, was charged and is awaiting trial for police brutality after the released footage shows him and other officers responding to a noise complaint by breaking down the door of an Albany residence and immediately dragging out and beating the residents. Later in the video, a one removed resident was shown in with his hands up before being tackled by Deere, who proceeded to violently beat him in the face with a club before being pulled off by other officers. U.S. measles have surged again and are on a pace to set a record for most illnesses in 25 years. So far this year, health officials have confirmed 555 measles cases, including 90 in the last week alone. While 20 states have reported cases, New York has been the epicenter of the outbreak. Nearly two-thirds of all cases have been in New York, and 85% of the latest week's cases from the state. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that all children get two doses of measles vaccine.
This past Saturday, more than 200 girls filled the classrooms of Tech Smart in Ballston Spa for the 7th annual Girls in STEM workshop. Students got a chance to interact in classes designed to illustrate the fun side of science and technology. Some workshops included art, solar field designs, and animation.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Albany has been tense in recent weeks as the city government and citizens confront a case of police brutality. The mayor and police chief refused to attend a town hall meeting on gun violence at the North Albany YMCA, but community rallies for greater awareness continue. WOOC was there and at the subsequent street rallies to hear the voices of the city.
We want justice.
We want justice.
We won't be quiet.
We won't be quiet.
We won't be quiet.
We won't be quiet.
It's been an unsettled few weeks here in the Capital District since an Albany police officer was charged April 2nd with felony assault and a misdemeanor count of official misconduct following an early morning incident on March 16th at a West Hill home where three men were arrested after police broke down their door attempting to stop a party. Cell phone footage of the police's actions showed them beating three men in the street outside of their First Street home. Mayor Kathy Sheehan and Police Chief Eric Hawkins then held a press conference. Body cam footage was later released of the incident showing Officer Luke Deere using a baton to hit Armando Sanchez in the face. Charges against all three men were dropped by the county DA's office. Two other officers were suspended and have since further charges discussed being brought against them. Last Monday, on April 8th, the local group Justice or Else held a rally at the Frank Chapman Institute in West Hill that drew over 100 community members. And this past Thursday, the issue arose at a previously scheduled Spectrum Television Town Hall event on gun violence at the Capital District YMCA on North Pearl Street in North Albany.
You all around from Star?
Again for being here. I believe we're going to have a great conversation this evening, and
I'm Paul Smart of WCAALP in Albany, reporting for WOOCLP here in Troy. I attended last week's meeting. I think we caught a sense of what was going on. Preceding the town hall discussion was a screening of a new film from Spectrum Television, which focused on the gun violence from last summer throughout the city of Albany, with an emphasis on the murder of Snug 518 worker Elijah Cancer, whose parents were among the most effective speakers for the evening, along with the head of Snug, Jerome Brown.
There are a lot of issues we want to get to tonight. Incident is making that hard for many residents. An Albany police officer was accused of brutally beating an unarmed black man while responding to a call. We did invite the Albany Police Department to participate in tonight's town hall, but they told us they did not have anyone available. Mayor Sheen's office did not respond to it.
Hi, my name is Sydney. My question is directed towards the Cancer family. I would like to know if there are any words that you would like to say to the community to inform them.
Stuck with right here. We have to change that.
The day after the YMCA program, I talked to a number of people at the Y about the previous night's town hall meeting. Everybody said that they were particularly upset that the mayor's office and the police did not show up. They were also very impressed that it was the Black community that came out, and unimpressed by the fact that no other media covered the event. One of the men I talked to runs a number of programs for social agencies around the area. He didn't want to identify himself, but talked about new efforts that are underway with federal and state funding, whereby those who use guns within a community are identified and then brought in for counseling before they are arrested with the guns. He seemed hopeful about this program and also about the growing number of activities that are going on within communities, including the efforts of SNUG. On Sunday, it took some finding, but we finally caught up with another rally tied to the police action on First Street.
I'm Derek Johnson, councilman in the 2nd Ward in Northern New York. Today, the family would like to speak out to the injustice that was done towards their family member, and we have other victims of the same incident. So it's just protesting, letting, you know, making some noise about a situation that left a very bad taste in the community's mouth. We got to make sure that we send a message that when things like this happen, the community is not going to sit back and let it go. You know, business as usual is over with. That time is over with. Our community wants more, expects more, and when we don't get it and things like this happen, we're going to make noise about it.
And will the rallies and protests like this be continuing?
Yes, as long as they're needed. As long as they're needed. If we don't see our demands and we don't feel like it's being taken serious, yes, we will assemble a gathering as needed.
Who's kind of helping organize this? Is it coming from everybody?
The issue is organizing itself, because it's been going on for so long, and you know, now it's time for real justice to breathe fresh air. Justice for everyone.
This has been Paul Smart from WCAA LP in Albany reporting for WOOC LP in Troy.
No more hurt.
No more hurt.
We want justice.
We want justice.
We want justice.
We want justice.
And police brutality.
And police brutality.
And police brutality.
And police brutality.
No more hurt.
No more hurt.
We demand
accountability.
We demand
truth.
We demand
accountability.
We demand
truth.
We demand
accountability.
All right.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
The Hudson Mohawk Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Underground Railroad History Project LibertyCon 2019 conference, seeking sanctuary, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness at Siena College, March 29th through 31st, 2019. This is part three of a five-part segment. In this segment, we'll hear from Donald Hyman, independent researcher, about his workshop on Aretha Franklin, Activism, Pride, and Respect.
Willie Terry, your labor roaming correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm here at Siena College at the Underground Railroad Conference. And I'm at a workshop right now called Aretha Franklin, Activism, Pride, and Respect. And this workshop has been done by Donna Hyman, who is an independent researcher. How are you doing, Donna?
Hey, I'm doing great, Willie. Glad to see you here. Thanks for coming by.
So you're doing a workshop on Aretha Franklin. What's significant about Aretha Franklin?
Well,
I'm talking about at the Underground Railroad.
Well, because you're looking at the fact that if you're connecting her to the struggles that the Underground Railroad is talking about, that African-American men and women had to go through, she basically is a continuation of that struggle. And she becomes a pivotal point at a time in African-American history in the 60s when the civil rights movement was at its peak. Her involvement with Dr. King and the movement goes back even further. So I connected that to the Underground Railroad and the struggles. First of all, her family comes out of Mississippi. I'm talking about on her mother's side, and on her father's side. And we're talking about Deep South. We're talking about sharecroppers. We're talking about segregation. We're talking about racism. We're talking about finding a way out of that. And in her case, her father was a minister. And as you know, in most African-American communities, even through slavery time and back to Africa, the spiritual advisor had a very important position in the community. And that continues. Along with the changes that went about in America post-Civil War, we know that during Reconstruction, African-Americans became were able made citizens, given the right to vote. Slavery was outlawed, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And what goes about as a result of that is a form of enfranchisement where you have at least 3,000 elected officials by 1875 in the South. But all of this is turned around after with the Hayes Compromise, and the Union pulls out soldiers, and the South rewrites its own state constitutions, which slowly but surely disenfranchise African American voters, and they lose a considerable amount of political rights in the South until we go about in the 1950s and 60s with the Civil Rights Movement. How is that significant, and how is it connected to Aretha Franklin? Well, like I said, her family, especially her father, was very active. One of the things that was significant about African-American community in the United States in the 1920s, that with the coming of industrialization in the primary northern cities like Chicago, Detroit, New York City, Philadelphia, there is a migration to those areas specifically for work purposes. In those areas, communities develop in Detroit, in Chicago, in New York, in Philadelphia. And those areas, people, when they come, they bring their culture with them. And how does, back to Aretha Franklin, how does this relate? One of the cultural phenomena that we talk about is the church. And her father is a Baptist minister. And he's in the 1950s, he will pastor one of the largest Baptist churches in Detroit, New Bethel. She lives in the community. However, her family is kind of at a higher level in terms of social status because of the fact that he's a minister.
Did you say she was a black, family was a black middle class during that time?
I would say even upper black middle class, because they kind of stayed in a mansion, which is owned by the church, but you know, he's driving around in a Cadillac, and they go to schools, and they have people that cook for them and wait on them. So,
what was the father's name?
Reverend C.L. Franklin. He was one of the prominent ministers of the 50s. Mm-hmm. Now, I need to connect with what your initial question was. Mm-hmm. How does this connect to the Underground Railroad? Well, this path to freedom that African Americans have sought throughout their time in the New World. Part of the Great Migration was to escape some of the oppression and lack of opportunities in the South of the United States. But remember, when people migrate and move, they bring their culture. They bring their religion, they bring their food, they bring their music, they bring their dance, they bring their philosophy. And one of the things that's important is we see... We're able to see the greatest influence in terms of their music because it comes out of the South. The gospel music that they do in their churches, it has a lot of feeling. It's very improvisational. It rides the theme. It doesn't have a 2-minute limit or 3-minute limit. When people migrate to Chicago, where they have Salem Baptist, or they go to Abyssinia in Harlem, they bring that tradition with them of worshiping and praising. And part of that is the songs that they sing. Back to Reverend C.L. Franklin. He has a church. He has children, Aretha Franklin, her brother Cecil, her sister Irma, and they sing in the church. And when she's a very young age, she's very gifted. And we're talking about listening to somebody like Art Tatum, who comes to visit his father and able to play what he's playing. She plays by ear. She's got like this genius thing at 6 or 7. And her father encourages her to sing. And one of the songs she loves is a Sam Cooke song, who's also a guest at their house from time to time, is Jesus Be a Fence Around Me. By the time Aretha Franklin is 15, and then like 1958, she records a gospel album called Songs of Faith. One of the songs on there is Precious Lord. It's recorded in the church. And one of her father's good friends is Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who comes to speak at the church. Now, if you know anything about the 1950s, it's around 1958 when all of the stuff that's going on in Montgomery, the bus ride, Dr. King comes to prominence and sort of looked at as a leader of the civil rights movement because of the success of that boycott in Montgomery with Rosa Parks. Okay. And so one of the people that go in 1958 on tour with him, because the preachers will speak, they'll have a singer before that, is Aretha Franklin, who's a friend of the family, who's good friends with her father. And so her connection to Dr. King goes back a long way before she sings at his funeral in 1968. Today in my workshop, I have a flyer where the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King's organization, was having financial problems in 67. Aretha Franklin does 10 shows. At this time, she's getting about $15,000, $20,000 a concert. And in 1967, that was enough to buy a house, a car, and maybe send your kids to college, the value of the money. She donates what's like $250,000, which would be equivalent to about $2 or $3 million today, to his organization. Her connection is very large, and her father's connection in 63, in June, before the March on Washington. In Detroit, they have the largest march in American history, which is called the Great Walk. Her father sets that up. So her family and her were always involved actively in the civil rights movement. It wasn't something they picked up because everybody marched on Washington. They had been doing it. Dr. King stayed at their house. Aretha talks about him getting up one morning and asking their cook what they had. And she said, I got bacon, I got eggs, I got some sausages. He said, well, I'm going to have some bacon, some eggs, and some sausages. So her then becoming the Queen of Soul, and at a time when African-Americans and America is mourning the loss of one of the greatest leaders, her presence on television, where it's 150 million people watching, and it's not Diana Ross or Dionne Warwick or Nancy Wilson singing Precious Lord, it's Aretha Franklin. And the reason that she's up there singing it is not because she's at the height of her fame. They're not picking her because she's at the height of the fame for doing respect. It's because there already was a continual connection between her family that went all the way back to when she was a teenager and a little girl.
Don, I want to say that the things you're saying, like a lot of people didn't know, you know, how deeply involved Aretha Franklin was.
That's why I'm doing this.
With the civil rights movement and the struggle of African Americans in this country.
That's why I'm doing this.
And I want to ask you, just tell me just a little bit about yourself. I know I call you Soul Man, and you got jazz playing in the background. Are you the jazz man too? But I also wanted you to tell people how to get in touch with you, you know, if they want to have you to come and, you know, talk to them about this subject.
Okay, I would love to. You can reach me at DonaldHyman567@yahoo.com. That's DonaldHyman567@yahoo.com.
Donald, thank you for acquiescing to this interview to talk about the Queen of Soul, which is so important.
Okay, thank you too.
And that was our correspondent Willie Terry speaking with Donald Hyman. For those just tuning in, I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Chris Gulley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have any comments, suggestions, or a tiny, tiny sound, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
The organization Capital District Latinos held a forum on environmental and climate justice in Albany on April 13th. Correspondent Mark Dunley spoke with Dan Isereri, head of Capital District Latinos, and Willie White, co-founder of A Village in the south end of Albany, about the impact of oil bomb trains and diesel truck emissions on the port of Albany.
So there is an environmental and climate justice from Puerto Rico to Albany event on Saturday, April 13, at the Cultural Empowerment and Community Engagement Center. And we're talking with one of the hosts and chairman, Dan Isarari, who is the chairman of the Capital District Latinos. Dan, maybe you just start off saying a little bit about what your organization is and why you agreed to help with this event.
Well, Capital District Latinos has been around since 2009, approximately, when we sorry, 2011, when we incorporated as a nonprofit. Our aim is to create the conditions for success in the Latino community, other communities of color as well. And we've been advocating for our community for as long as we've been around. We just recently, when I say recently, a year and a half ago, bought the building that we're currently in, which we have renamed the Cultural Empowerment Community Engagement Center, formerly the St. John's Evangelical Lutheran Church. And what we have come to use this place for is as a gathering place for people in the community who have different issues that they are trying to tackle, different groups that need places to meet, and basically community functions.
And so today the forum is on, you know, environmental justice. How does that particularly impact upon, you know, say the Latino community?
So about a year ago, or it's almost a year since we had a wonderful event here. June 1st is the beginning of hurricane season in the Caribbean. And we brought a traveling troupe of actors from Puerto Rico to the center. And that group of actors basically performed a piece that they had put together in the island of Puerto Rico during the aftermath of the hurricane. And so what that did for us basically was to unite the struggles around climate justice and the community of Albany. Because in Puerto Rico, we really have kind of ground zero in terms of climate justice issues. Not just because of Maria. Maria just was kind of the part that, the straw that broke the camel's back. Actually, a century or more of colonization had really created some serious conditions economically, socially, environmentally on the island. And so we found ourselves connected to that struggle.
And, you know, what are some of the issues you've been working on, you know, locally here in the Capital District, particularly around climate justice or environmental justice issues?
Well, it's not so much that we focused on that piece. We're focused in terms of creating a different environment, so to speak, a social environment for our community. So it is, I think it's all of a piece. We have, for example, been the driving force behind the creation of an opioid treatment clinic across the street, known as Camino Nuevo. And so all of these issues are interconnected. And in the Latino community, especially now during this in this environment of racial animus, we find ourselves a place where people can come to organize around those issues.
Now, most Americans, other than, you know, possibly the president, you know, do know that Puerto Rico is, you know, part of the United States, but mm-hmm. certainly very much still suffers, of course, from, you know, basically a colonial status. Do you have any thoughts about what needs to happen in terms of, you know, the continued rebuild of Puerto Rico to help the average person, not the, you know, North American investors for the tourist industry, but also to move, say, to, you know, a real renewable energy system rather than the incredibly expensive, you know, electric system they presently have?
For me, that begins with debt relief. It also begins with a loosening of these strictures on this spending for a disaster. So President Trump has to stop saying that Puerto Rico gets more than anybody, when in fact very little has been actually dispersed to the island. There does need to be some structural changes in terms of the politics in Puerto Rico, but the Puerto Rican people will eventually have to deal with that.
Thank you very much. We're talking with Dan Irizarry, who is the chairman of Capital District Latinos. Next, we talked to Willie White, one of the founders of A Village, and he was one of the speakers on environmental justice. Willie, what were some of the points you were making to the crowd today?
So I just want people to know, I mean, first of all, please, let's not forget about the people at Ezra Prentice. Ezra Prentice is comprised of about 400 residents. Over half of those residents are kids under 14 years old. And they're suffering in silence down there. I basically believe it's breathing while black, because this community is largely ignored by the governor, to be honest with you. We're looking for the governor to come speak with us and talk to us about the environmental issues down there. Any sane person would know that those residents shouldn't be living in an industrial area. You have the Port of Albany there. They're right in the middle of 787, recycling plant, county waste, a thousand diesel trucks every day going through their community. The bomb train sits in their backyard. They're surrounded by toxic air. What are they breathing? Breathing while black.
Have the residents complain about particular health problems in the situation?
Constantly. As a matter of fact, when we, as a former executive director of a Village Inc., when we first embarked on a study down there, we encountered lung cancer. We encountered thyroid issues, prevalent in diabetes. Asthma rate is through the roof. There's a lot of issues down there. Residents complain, but I'd be honest with you, a lot of residents are afraid to publicly complain because they're afraid they might lose their housing. And so I understand why they stay in the background. That's why I kind of elevate my voice to become a little louder, because I'm speaking for a community down there. I truly believe that.
Now, say if the port was, located a little bit south of this neighborhood, say the town of Bethlehem, what do you think the response, would that be any different from the government officials?
Of course, because I truly believe that if this was a white community, that it wouldn't happen in there. Because I'm going to tell you, when people stand up, when people who have the means to stand up, they will stand up. But a lot of people down there don't have the means because, as I stated before, they're afraid they would lose their housing. But if this was a white community, no, this would not happen in that community, especially Bethlehem. I think the port tried to expand going south into Bethlehem, and they was told no. So now the Port of Albany is saying they would gladly pitch in some money to help relocate Ezra Prentice because they want the property. They're not concerned about the people. They want the property.
And how do residents feel about being relocated?
Well, there's a lot of mixed messages and mixed feelings down there because, a lot of them live down there most of their lives. It's a comfortable place to live. You can't see toxic in the air, so it's hard to convince some residents, but a lot of residents do want to move because they understand the impact on their health from breathing this toxic air every single day.
Now, I assume a village is still down there trying to work on particular concerns?
Yes, very much so. A village is deeply involved. We're also working with the executive director of the Radix Center, who are working with the School of Public Health to do a healthcare study down there, Dr. Stacy Pettigrew. She's doing an awesome job. She has some firm numbers. And this fight is a long way from being over. Eventually, we will get the results that is desired, is for our residents at Ezra Prentice to live in a healthy community.
Now, on the off chance that Governor Cuomo in his limousine ride does manage to put on our radio station on air and listens to you, you have a short message to the governor?
Yes, Governor. To be honest with you, I voted for you because I believe you're going to do the right thing when it comes to Ezra Prentice. So please come and visit us. I mean, I was at a graduation of a couple of weeks ago, and the governor, I was actually graduating from a program, and the governor sent me a plaque. So I appreciate that plaque, but Governor, that's not enough. I need you to come and talk to the people at Ezra Prentice. They are suffering. They are dying in silence. They're suffering in silence. So please come and visit us.
And that was Willie White, and this has been Mark Dumley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Corin Carey is the Senior Campaign Director for Compassion and Choices, working to get Medical Aid in Dying Act passed in New York and New Jersey. Just last week, New Jersey passed the bill, and New York's Governor Cuomo spoke in favor of the legislation. Corin joins us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine to tell us more.
So you're just back from New Jersey, where Governor Murphy signed a bill that you've been working on for a long time. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Governor Murphy signed a bill called the Medical Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act. This makes New Jersey the eighth state and the ninth jurisdiction that allows terminally ill people to say to their doctor, look, if you can't cure me, and you can't relieve my suffering. I'd like a prescription for medication that I can take to ease my suffering and die a peaceful death.
Okay. How long have you been working on this for?
The bill was originally introduced in New Jersey in 2012, so the campaign has been going on for 7 years.
Wow.
Building grassroots support, finding people to tell their own stories of loved ones who've suffered at the end of life. Terminally ill people have joined our campaign and died along the way. I took over the campaign 2 years ago, and we've been pressuring legislative leaders to take a vote for those past 2 years, aggressively pushing them to take a vote. The polling in New Jersey showed that a vast majority of New Jerseyans wanted this option. Almost every single newspaper editorialized in favor of the bill. All of the evidence were there. There had been multiple public hearings on the topic, multiple public forums on the topic, and the time was right. The legislature passed the bill at the end of March, the governor signed it on April 12th.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So now we know that New Jersey residents have this option. What about New York? The other day, Governor Cuomo spoke out in support of a similar bill in New York State. What stands in the way?
Well, New York's campaign kicked off in 2015. And so lawmakers are still considering the option. The bill hasn't moved as far as it did in New Jersey. In past years, the New Jersey Assembly passed it twice for a couple of years in a row. So New York is a little bit further behind, but I actually think that New Yorkers are going to look over the river and they're going to say it shouldn't be a zip code that separates us from the rights that terminally ill people in New Jersey have now. New York's bill is called the Medical Aid in Dying Act. Both New York and New Jersey's bill are modeled after Oregon's legislation, which was approved by voters in a referendum in 1994.
Wow.
Yeah. So we have now over 20 years of evidence showing that medical aid in dying works as intended. California passed the bill in 2015, and actually five states in 5 years have passed the bill. And so there's momentum. People are looking around the country and saying 20% of Americans now have this option. Why don't we? And I think that's what's going to happen in New York as well.
So what does the bill do and what is it going to take?
The bill would allow someone who is terminally ill, and the bill defines that as someone who has a terminal illness that is incurable and irreversible, and who has 6 months or less to live. Both of those facts have to be confirmed by two doctors. That person has to have the mental capacity to make their own medical decisions. It allows that person to ask their doctor for a prescription for medication that they can take at a time of their choosing or never, should their suffering become unbearable, so long as they can self-ingest the medication. The key to this legislation is patient autonomy. So from the beginning till the end of the process, it has to be self-directed. It has to be a contemporaneous decision by the patient, both to request the medication and then to take it and bring about a peaceful death. So that's basically what the bill would do. And additionally, there are about a dozen safeguards attached to the bill to make sure that that there's no coercion, that there's no misuse. In states that have adopted these laws, only about 0.5% of all of the deaths involve a request for medical aid in dying. Even when people get the medication, about a third of them don't take it. They either die before they decide to take the medication, or they just choose to live as long as they can. These are people who desperately want to live, but their illness is causing them to die. So most of these folks want to hang on as long as they can. It's only when suffering becomes absolutely unbearable that they turn to the medication. Interestingly, though, when people get it, this prescription, they often put it in the medicine cabinet and go about living the rest of their lives. It frees up their, they don't have to worry. They don't have to worry that they're stuck suffering. And it really brings a tremendous peace of mind. You asked me what it's going to take, and I think it's going to take people letting their elected officials know that they want this to happen. Laws don't pass themselves, and lawmakers don't act without being prompted by some outside force. So having people contact their senator, their assembly member, to let them know that this is something that they believe in is tremendously important. That's how we won the campaign in New Jersey, is that people came forward with stories of loved ones who died a very painful death, and they told those stories to lawmakers, and those lawmakers related, because we've all seen people die. If you're lucky enough to not have seen suffering, and death comes in ways that are, you know, idealized, with the wind blowing through the curtains and saying goodbye in a very peaceful way. Not all death is like that.
Right.
That's how we all want to envision the kind of death, sure, that we want to have, but it doesn't happen like that. And lawmakers who've seen deaths that are the opposite of that, with tremendous suffering, they're the first to want to support this.
Mm. What are the chances, you think, of getting this passed in 2019?
Well, I think that New Jersey provides a huge boost to the campaign here in New York, because we're so close, and I don't think that New Yorkers like to be outdone by New Jersey. Mm. I think that lawmakers are still pondering some of the ethical and philosophical issues, but really the questions have been asked and answered. We've had hearings here in New York. Experts have come in to testify, and the opposition is... it's really interesting. The opposition is saying the same exact thing today in 2019 that they were saying in 1994. New York had a task force on life and the law that looked at the issue of what they called at that time assisted suicide. Mm. And the same arguments that task force made when it recommended that the legislature not adopt an assisted suicide law then, you know, that the law would have a negative impact on poor people, people of color, people living with disabilities, people who were expensive and difficult to care for. Mm. Those same arguments that were made in 1994 are made by the opposition in 2019, as though there were no evidence, no data over that intervening, 25-year period to show that these laws actually work without the kind of coercion, abuse, misuse that people feared back in 1994.
Mm. So interesting. So it's looking like you are the senior campaign director for New York and New Jersey for this campaign, this nationwide campaign. It's looking like, New Jersey, check. New York coming. What would be next for Kerr and Carey?
Well, for me, the implementation is a big deal. Mm. So once a law is passed, the opposition has been very clever about fighting these laws in the courts. Mm. And also there's a huge public education component. Doctors need to feel comfortable with this, with responding to patient requests. Patients have to understand what this right means for them. And so there's a lot of work there to be done. But my work throughout my career has always been sort of on the edge. So for example, I worked on needle exchange before it was legal.
Right.
I worked on looking at the effect that restrictions on registered sex offenders had, showing that it didn't actually improve public safety, but put more people at risk. And so, decriminalizing the use of condoms for sex work. Mm. These are all things that seemed crazy at the time and now are becoming more mainstream. So I'm kind of looking around for the next issue that makes people's eyebrows rise.
Do you have any ideas?
I do. I work with dying people now, and so the issues of end of life care are hugely important to me, and I'm following very closely the research that shows that LSD, acid, psilocybin mushrooms really help people deal with existential fear at the end of life, the fear of what's next after we leave this life, and the idea that these kinds of substances can bring relief to people who are really suffering from that worry at the end of life is very exciting to me. I see what medical marijuana has done for people who are dying, and I think that if we can provide another measure of relief, that's something that I'd very much like to do.
And that was Corinne Carey speaking with Melissa Bromley about the Medical Aid in Dying Act in New York. For those just tuning in, boy, have you missed a lot. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Longtime musician, journalist, and artist Greg Hames died unexpectedly on April 10th. Among his many creative endeavors was the local music blog Nippertown, which ended with his death after almost 10 years. Last year, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Aaron Pedinati spoke with Greg about his work on Nippertown.
I'm Aaron Pedinati, and today I'm interviewing Greg Hames, who is one of the editors and writers for the online magazine Nippertown.com. Greg, thanks for coming in today. It's good to be talking to you.
Well, let's hope so. Thanks, Aaron.
All right. Well, we'll find out. Right?
Yes, we will. Right.
So to start out, can you tell us about Nippertown.com? What is it, and what sort of topics does it cover?
Well, it's as you said, it's a online, I would say, arts and entertainment magazine. Sort of a little bit of everything on there. It's pretty hyper-local. Capital Region, Berkshires, Hudson Valley primarily.
And a little bit of Massachusetts too, right?
Yeah, so yeah. Berkshires, yeah, definitely. There's definitely some Berkshire stuff in there. I like to go over to Mass Mocha or Iron Horse or places like that, or in Pittsfield. There's a lot going on over there that I think the people in Capital Region tend to forget about. So as we try to plug a lot of that stuff. There's a lot of, it starts off every day with a roundup of daily tips of events you can go and partake, check out. There's interviews, reviews, previews. There's a number of features that run on a sort of weekly basis. Art beat, sort of visual arts roundup of what's going on. It's daily flashback. We do a little bit of funny history stuff and music and culture stuff. Wednesdays, we usually have the Hump Day Unusual Moment in tribute to Lynn Bramer, formerly of WQBK, who started that many, many years ago. Just some weird, odd music video usually. Thursdays we have the On This Date in Local 518 Concert History. And on Fridays, we, for the people who don't come to see Nippertown on a regular basis throughout the week, we always publish Hot Reads, which is a roundup of the top 12 most viewed stories of the week. So that if you're only tuning in one day a week, come on Friday afternoon and see what everybody else has been seeing.
So how and when did it get its start?
Well, this is almost exactly the 9th anniversary. Started on, we went live on May 21st, 9 years ago. And Metroland was still around at that point. And before we even had our first anniversary, we had placed third in their readers poll of best local arts website. And then after we'd been there a year, we were number one. So it was like it grew really fast as far as audience recognition and acceptance. It started out just as I had written for the Times Union for, I think, as a staff member about 18 years, 19 years. And before that, Schenectady Gazette, and before that, Metroland, and before that, little fanzines around town. So I've been writing all this time, but at the Times Union, the news hall just kept shrinking, and there was not much room for arts and entertainment. And so I decided to leave there and just start up my own little thing. First time I really sort of took the reins myself and my wife, Sarah Ayers, co-edit the monster, as we call it. It's, we do about 8 posts a day during the week and 1 post a day on the weekends. So it's a lot of content providing going on.
Well, that relates to my next question, which is, can you tell us a bit about what goes into editing an online culture, arts, and entertainment magazine? First of all, what does the job involve in terms of the actual editing process?
Well, we have a, it's very much driven by community contributors. So we have a bunch of really excellent local writers and photographers who submit mostly reviews, some interviews, and some other odd pieces here and there. But they're mostly, I would say, concert reviews. And everybody has their own different style of writing, of course. So I try to maintain their voice, but then it's got to fit into the Nippertown format, which is, got to recode everything and put in all the links. And it's a time-consuming effort. I think that's the really one of the biggest challenges about doing the editing for Nippertown is just how time-intensive it is. Mm-hmm. But once and you can't include everything. That's the other real challenge is deciding what to highlight, what to focus. Because there's so much going on in this town. People who think this is Smallbony, as they say, I think they just don't know where to look to find the things that would make them happy.
Right.
And that's what we try to do.
Yeah. And is the time intensiveness of it partly related to the fact that it's online? So you have a bunch of different people in a bunch of different places all submitting stuff at once, and you kind of have to process it all?
Yeah. A lot of the time intensive stuff has to do with just plain old doing online research. As far as not always getting information from, say, the venue or from the act, but going out and actively finding the information. I mean, there's any number of times when I think this morning I did. I posted a concert announcement before the venue sent out their concert announcement, just because I was looking at their website or I saw something mentioned on Facebook or something, and follow the path. So that's what takes a lot of the time, is actually trolling around, doing the research, and but it is also trying to balance. I don't want to have 2 or 3 jazz reviews all on the same day. I want to, want to have a folk review and a, heavy metal review and a theater review, and sort of spread them out a bit so that things are a little more balanced art-wise.
Right. So time is the challenge. Can you tell us a little bit about the rewards of this editing process?
Well, I mean, I really think the best reward of about Nippertown is that it's immediate. Having spent time writing for monthlies and weeklies and dailies, there's always a time lag. And now it's like immediate. Like I said, I can post something before the venue even announces that it's happening. And that's, again, that's having the time to do that, though, to be there when you find it and get it immediately online. The other thing about the other real reward about doing Nippertown is going to a show and having somebody come up to you and say, "Oh, thank you, Nippertown. If I hadn't seen this on Nippertown, I never would have known about this, and it was great." We tried to search out some of the what I would call interesting and oddball things, rather than,
right.
I mean, if it comes down to doing, spotlighting some, say, trumpet and drum duo at the Sanctuary, or David Matthews at SPAC, I think David Matthews is not going to make the cut. So,
especially after, 40 million years of him.
Yes, well,
back, right?
There's that too. I've written about music and art for a long time, and at this point, I'm really looking for the more interesting, more adventurous stuff, the unusual.
So, last question: when I looked at the About Nippertown section on the website, a part of this description read as follows. Why Nippertown? Question mark. We like dogs. We like music. We especially like large outdoor sculptures of dogs that look like they're listening to music. This was posted below a picture of a dog lying on a black and white tile floor with a small porcelain sculpture of another dog sitting near its face, seemingly looking into its eyes. Scrolling back through the articles on the site, I discovered that there's a semi-recurrent motif of dog pictures.
Oh, yeah.
So can you comment on the canine component of Nippertown's content?
Well, yeah, we're dog people, you know.
Comes down to that.
Actually, my wife wrote that that beautiful little two sentences about dogs and sculptures and music. When we were starting, before we'd started Nippertown, actually, we were thinking about doing something and trying to come up with a name that would be local, but not, you know, sort of specific. I didn't want to call it the Albany something or mm-hmm. the Troy something.
Right.
And we decided that the two most, you know, distinctive landmarks were the Egg and Nipper. And we couldn't really do the Egg because that's a venue. We wanted to do something that was a little more open-ended.
Right.
And so we decided on
the Egg would be cliche at this point.
Well, yeah. To anybody local, certainly, yeah. But Nipper was, you know, so we did a couple of searches to see what domain names were available. Mm-hmm. And Nippertown was open. And we said, yeah, let's Nippertown. That's you know, we can make that as broad and a geographic area as we want it to be. Mm-hmm. So we picked Nippertown. And the photo I think you're talking about, I think, is our dog Shelby with a little miniature Nipper by his nose. We started off with a two dog canine advisory board. We lost Kale, but Shelby is carrying on, and we try to every week end the week with sort of thank you called It's the Weekend, and at the top of that column is a photo of Shelby. And as to why, it's because it makes us happy.
Well, that's a good reason. And Nippertown definitely works a lot better than Eggtown, too. So,
yeah. Well, it probably would have been Eggville or, you know. Mm-hmm. You know.
Sounds like it's time to bring a little puppy onto the advisory board.
Yes. But, well, we have been discussing that. Yeah. But.
Well, Greg, thanks very much for this interview. It was very nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Aaron.
And that was a rebroadcast of Aaron Pettinati's interview with the recently passed musician, journalist, and artist, Greg Hames.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
And that concludes our show for tonight. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dave Pueblo.
And I'm Chris Scully. Our engineer tonight is Imani Taylor, the purple one. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a terrible tale of intrigue and insubordination, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Who wrote that script? As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. Oh, if you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.